painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
This week on Artbeat, we feature a new personification of an artist, the writer. John Reimringer is the author of the newly released book entitled Vestments. This book chronicles the life of a priest in St. Paul and his struggles with his faith, his past, and himself. We will also offer the first half of a reading from his book. This is part one of our interview with author John Reimringer. So why don't you tell me a little about yourself?
Well, I was born in Fargo, North Dakota. Grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and my wife and I moved to the Twin Cities in 2001. I've been a journalist and basically a newspaper and public relations editor. I've been a library clerk, and I got an MFA in creative writing at the University of Arkansas in 1998, and that's kind of where I started working on writing.
So you've always kind of been connected to writing then?
Yeah, in one way or another. I mean, I think the everything from the journalism to the working in a library were ways of being around books, because I think I'd always wanted to be a writer and didn't really know how to go about doing that.
I know that, you know, journalistic writing is different than, like, creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And are those differences obvious, or are they more similar than people think?
Oh, boy. I think that they're very different. I mean, the discipline of writing, of having to sit down and do it, I think journalism's a really good training for that. It's certainly, and I was more of an editor, so that's certainly training and honing your own writing and other people's writing. But journalism is a completely different type of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's drier, certainly. Different space to be in entirely.
So your book, Vestments. Can you tell me a little bit about the synopsis, maybe brief synopsis of the book?
Brief synopsis of the book. Young Catholic priest in trouble with the church for a brief, really more of a flirtation, not even an affair, but a brief flirtation with a woman. And he goes on leave. He's kind of given the choice between being transferred to a parish he doesn't want to go to or going on leave. He goes on leave, comes home to St. Paul, where he is thrown back into contact with his violent bar fighter father, whom he was kind of fleeing in the first place, and also with his high school girlfriend, who is a Mexican lawyer and in the midst of a divorce.
You have a lot of history with St. Paul. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, when I moved to St. Paul in 01 with my wife, it was the first time I'd lived there. But my dad's family had been there since 1856. And my great-grandfather immigrated from Prussia and owned a saloon and grocery store in downtown St. Paul. And his name was Theodore Wieman, and then my great-grandfather, Michael Reimringer, married into the Wieman family, and we'd always heard this kind of family legend that Theodore was not happy when Michael married his daughter, Anna. And we discovered, we found an old city directory, actually online in Google Books for 1879 of St. Paul, and we discovered that not only was Michael Reimringer a clerk for Theodore Wieman, but he was also boarding with the family. So we kind of wonder whether there's a little hanky-panky with the boss's daughter there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were married in 1880 in November in Assumption Church in downtown St. Paul. And in 1887, Michael Reimringer got drunk at the second St. Paul Winter Carnival, fell off the back of a sleigh, cracked his skull, and died.
No.
So, and then my grandfather and father and brother were all born in St. Paul as well. So yeah, I do have a long family history.
But you said that you're from Fargo.
I was born in Fargo. We moved to Topeka, Kansas when I was two. So
okay.
I mean, I grew up in Topeka, lived about 30 years total in Kansas. And the weird thing about all that, though, was when my wife and I moved to St. Paul, I instantly felt at home there in a way I'd never felt in Kansas. And just fell in love with the city, and in part the novel's a bit of a love letter to the city, and it's kind of written in that blush of first love, so it's very enthusiastic about the city of St. Paul.
Would you say that then the city inspired you to write the book, or were you already inspired to write the book?
I was already struggling with writing the book. I kind of had the father-son conflict going, but when it really took off when I moved to the city and decided to kind of move the setting to set the novel in the city. And there were bits and pieces of family history that fell into the book as well. I mean, the book's not autobiographical at all, but the further back you get in kind of James's family history, the more like mine it is. And so it was this kind of coming together of family history and this place that my family was from with this book I was already trying to write that kind of brought it to life.
So it all kind of fit together. It just happened to fit together.
Yeah, it did.
Your characters, they sound very, you know, developed. Are they people that you know, or are they people that you aspire to be, or are they people that you think you are?
Not quite any of those, okay. I guess.
I mean, they could be anything.
You know, James certainly isn't me, although I grew up Catholic. He's a better Catholic than I was, and a different type of Catholic than I was. I grew up in kind of the liberal flowering of the Catholic Church after Vatican II, and, you know, the kind of the Catholic Church of probably my teens was, you know, guitar masses and kind of very touchy-feely. And James kind of is attracted to more kind of like the older generation of priests that were around when I was a kid they tended to be World War II and Korean War veterans, and they were, you know, they were very progressive and liberal socially, pretty conservative sexually, but they were, you know, they were a different sort of priest than the kind of priests I grew up, you know, with. And so that's different. You know, a lot of the characters, they're bits and pieces of people I knew. But it's like if a person was like a statue, it's like you hit that statue with a hammer and you pick up the pieces and you use the ones that fit.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What kind of research did you do for the book?
All kinds. I read several books on priests, especially a couple of books. One was a study of the first 5 years of the priesthood, and another was a book by a guy who had been in seminary and dropped out, and then 20 years later at a class reunion decided to write a book about what had happened to his classmates, both those who had stayed and those who had left. And so I got both of those books were really helpful because they had a lot of the priest's own words in them. And I learned reading them what I'd already kind of known because I grew up around a lot of priests. My parents were pretty active in the church. But books confirmed what I'd already known, which was that priests cussed. They, you know, were concerned about their jobs. They complained about their bosses, you know, the bishops and archbishops, the same as the rest of us do. They were concerned whether they'd have the money to retire. They were concerned whether they'd spent their lives in the right way. And also for a lot of them, they were very lonely, and not just lonely, not just for sex, but for intimacy. So basically they were guys. And I thought, you know, I mean, it's intimidating to think of writing a novel about priests. But once I started thinking about it, I'm writing this about guys who are priests, it was a lot easier. So that was a lot of the research.
Okay. How did you start your book? Where was your jumping off point?
The jumping off point, there was a poet named Richard Hugo who said, he wrote a book called The Triggering Town, and he said there's kind of a triggering impulse behind any piece of writing. And my jumping off point was basically the kind of the conflict between the priest and his father. And particularly the shoving match at the start of the book was always there. And it was kind of based on a college roommate I'd had who had a kind of violent bar fighter type of father who was a fascinating character. That guy was a fundamentalist Christian, and he would lay on the couch and drink beer and smoke cigarettes and then, you know, and argue with the TV preachers, and then he'd get up and, you know, go down to a bar and get in a fight. And he was a fascinating guy to be around. And so that was kind of the triggering character behind Joe Dressler, the father figure in the novel, and that conflict between a son who's, you know, tough in his own right, but also, you know, a little more sensitive, and so on, with this pretty profane, violent father was kind of the starting moment for the book.
And from there, Did you know where you wanted the book to go, or were you just kind of writing and seeing how it ended up?
I knew that the book was going to end at the wedding dance, and I didn't know what decision James would make. I'm trying not to give too much away. I didn't know what decision James would make at the wedding dance. It's the wedding. He, at the very end of the book, he's the priest who says the mass at his brother's wedding, and he's got a decision to make after that. It's almost, and this has happened to me writing a lot of stories too, it's almost as though you're standing on the bank of the Mississippi and you're going to build a bridge, and you know where you're going to start, and you can see the spot on the other bank where you're going to end, and you got to figure out how to get, you know, and that bridge is the arc of the story. And so the middle is the tough part.
Yeah. But you knew you had these themes and things you wanted to tackle throughout.
Right.
Just how you went about doing it was to be determined.
Exactly. And, you know, in the story, if it's a good story, the story always surprises you at times along the way.
Now an excerpt from the second half of Rhymeringer's book, Vestments. The passage is a flashback of James's relationship in high school with a Mexican girl, Betty Garcia.
We dated all that school year, and by summer we were fighting about birth control. I wanted to use the rhythm method, while Betty called that Vatican roulette and insisted on rubbers. Whatever I'd said, sex still scared me. In junior high, a couple of heavy-set, middle-aged women from Birthright had visited our classroom, armed with films that proved birth control was both a sin and unreliable, and that premarital sex led directly to the murder of unborn children. Our school nuns told us sexuality was a gift from God for married couples. As we prepared for confirmation, they told us boys the Holy Spirit would make us soldiers of God, that if we were disciplined and strong, we'd be worthy of a girl dressed in blue and pure as the Virgin Mary. At the end of eighth grade, I had watched Susan Redding, the nun's favorite, crowned at a school mass celebrating Mary, the Queen of May. Susan stood on the altar in a long butter-yellow dress with a garland of daisies in her hair, and I dreamed that night of a virgin bride. Now I worried that intercourse with Betty would leave her soiled in my eyes, but I couldn't tell her that, and so we argued. Since grade school, I'd worked every other Saturday morning answering the phone in the rectory office, and sometimes Father Phil would stop in, back from an early morning trip to the lake in a fishing hat and vest, or with a handful of papers for me to file, or with a parishioner in tow, and talk to me about the priesthood. We were friends, sort of. I'd served Mass for him since grade school, and back then we talked about the priesthood afterward while he hung his vestments and I sealed the plastic baggie of unconsecrated hosts and carefully rinsed the chalice and cruets and made sure the markers were in place for the readings at noon Mass. Phil was the sort of priest a boy from a family like mine could imagine becoming. He was a short, round man with jug ears and a whiskied face, and if he pulled you aside about something, he meant business. His priesthood was the priesthood of the men's club. He'd been a chaplain in Korea and drank at the VFW with other veterans. He bowled in the Veterans Administration League with my grandfather, and he fished and tied his own flies with fingers that were thick and calloused and surprisingly nimble. When I told him I was afraid I didn't think about God enough to be a priest, he waved a hand. "Priests don't think about God any more than your average Joe," he said. "Being a parish priest is about doing God's work. You can leave contemplation of the Almighty to the monks at St. John's." Because of Phil, I was part of the parish youth group. We visited nursing homes and the VA hospital, where Granddad had just retired as a veterans benefits counselor, and where he still took me for an occasional lunch and to buy dress shirts at a discount in the hospital canteen from his friend Jack Crow. Once a month, I lectured at Mass and afterward drove around with a lay minister bringing communion to shut-ins. Late one Saturday afternoon, I went to confession. Father Phil had met Betty, and I was sure he knew my voice and shadow in the confessional just as well as I knew the smell of his heavy aftershave and the curve of his big nose through the carved wooden screen. When my eyes adjusted, I could make out his bald head and the fringe of gray hair, but he kept the fiction of anonymity. After I'd made my confession, I saw him rub at one eyebrow with a knuckle. Then he spoke in a low voice. When a young woman loves a young man, she wants to show her love. And then it's up to the man to be strong for both of them. Remember, if you're seen leaving her house at all hours, it's her reputation that'll suffer. It would be best if you dated around, but I suppose you won't do that. Sometimes exercise helps. He paused, maybe embarrassed at the tumble of advice he'd given, and then finished with, "Say three Our Fathers, go to Mass every morning this month, and come back in 2 weeks." I said my penance and went to Mass and prayed for strength, but when I was with Betty, sin and reputation and the future paled again and again before the immediacy of her body, our desire. Then, on Saturday mornings, warm with the memory of how the night before Betty had drawn in her stomach as I slid my hand down the front of her jeans, I would file papers while Phil talked to me about the priesthood and answer him by asking if he'd caught any fish that morning or how he thought the grade school football team would do in the CYO League next fall. In July, Betty went on a long car trip with her parents to visit her father's family in Pueblo, Colorado, the Texas Panhandle, and Topeka, Kansas. She sent postcards of mountains, cactus, the world's longest grain elevator. This last, from Kansas, said, "I love you. I miss you. I hate Kansas, but I'm getting tan." That Saturday at the rectory, I found myself avoiding Father Phil. The next evening, when Betty came home, we drove slowly down Summit, hanging our elbows out the windows of the Plymouth, looking at the rich people's houses and remembering the night we'd gotten together. Betty picked out a favorite house on each block. At the end of Summit, I parked in the Overlook lot. We took a blanket from the trunk and walked a block south to where a wooded ravine cut through a bluff, down to the Mississippi. As soon as we stepped from the sidewalk into the woods, we were in a new world, a green chaos of trees, the trickle of water over a mossy stone lip and its insistent spatter on rock, a steep path slick with clay and stone. Halfway down, we were breathing hard, knuckles caked with clay where we'd slipped and caught ourselves, the occasional hum of a car on Mississippi River Boulevard, a distant reminder of a place we'd left. "Bet no one's down here tonight," Betty said. There was a patch of sand beach at the bottom of the ravine, a hollow in the bulge of the bluff with the ashes of a bonfire in front of it, charred driftwood and beer cans, a half-buried wine bottle. Kids came down here to party and scratch their names into the soft sandstone, but Betty was right. We had it to ourselves. We spread the blanket in the hollow and sat looking out on the river. The trees on the Minneapolis bank were thick and unbroken. In the channel, a buoy tilted with the current. It was a dry summer, and the water was low, and you could see the gravel shelving out under the ripples for a long way. The shadows of minnows flickered over the gravel. Betty and I hadn't seen each other for 3 weeks, and we sat there feeling the summer heat coming off our bodies. Betty's brown limbs were lean and dark in the night. I reached for her, and we rolled together on the blanket, pushing off each other's clothes. She'd tanned in a bikini every day of the trip, leaving white triangles over her breasts and belly. The rumble of a jet rising from the airport broke the still sounds of our breathing in the river. Betty reached across me and fumbled for her cutoffs. I found rubbers in the room my uncle from Colorado stays in when he visits Abuelita. "They only work half the time," I said. "Bullshit," Betty said. "Those numbers they gave us in Catholic school are propaganda. Ramon didn't mind." She stopped and stared at me, and I felt the way I had when, drunk after a skating party that winter, she dared me into racing across an unfamiliar lake in the dark. I remembered the slice of our skates, the way the wind forced tears from our eyes as we squinted ahead for the blackness that would be open water, the feeling of uncontrolled speed. You and Ramon? Swallows darted over the river from the cliff face behind us. Betty shrugged one shoulder. We hung out last summer. His family has a lake house, and me and his sister went there weekends to tan and water ski. I thought he was boring. He is, but he can ski. And fuck. So, I wanted to try it. It wasn't that big a deal. It must have been quite a summer. It was. Betty, in this mood, could not be shamed. She tore open the wrapper, wiggled the milky latex circle at me. I took it. I wanted this summer to be even better. That winter, Betty stayed Saturday nights with her grandmother on the west side. We weren't supposed to see each other those nights, but I would cross the river about 10, and Betty and I would crawl into the back seat of Mom's car with a blanket from the trunk, fumbling under heavy winter clothes until after midnight, the lovemaking better for the cramped quarters and the cold. Then her grandmother, worried by our late nights in the car, told her we could go upstairs, but to be careful. Abuelita came from a different world, from turn-of-the-century Mexico. She had still been a little girl when revolution drove her family from its ranch. Betty told me her grandmother remembered lanterns, wagons, and muffled voices, carefully packed heirlooms that were stolen at the border. In America, in reduced circumstances, she married at 16 and had a dozen children. She never learned English, living entirely in the Spanish-speaking world of St. Paul's Lower West Side, doing all of her shopping on Concord Street. When she talked with Betty at her kitchen table before bed, she included me by occasionally wagging a finger in my direction and laughing. The staircase in her house was tall and narrow, and she slept in the front room downstairs. Upstairs, Betty and I made love. Sometimes we dozed afterward. I had no set time to be home. And sometimes I would wake and sit by the lace-curtained windows, parting the curtains slightly to look out over the chain-link fences and alleyways of the snowy neighborhood, where Christmas lights were left up until March for the cheer they brought in the long winter, red and green and blue against the snow. St. Paul white nights. A foot of snow on the ground, a blanket of low clouds, the world between bathed in milky light. Nights bright enough for trees to throw shadows. The snow on garage roofs lay in long folds arranged by the wind. On the houses, bare shingles marked thin spots in the insulation. There was a gray fox hunting the backyards of the west side that winter, taking cats and rabbits. The neighbors said that it had likely come into town along the river. I spotted it from the bedroom window one night, flowing over a low fence like a ghost that left footprints in the fresh snow. Behind me, Betty lay under the quilt, hair spread about her face. All was still save for the metallic tapping of a radiator and the wind that made itself known more as a rising and falling pressure in the ears than a sound. The house breathed slow and deep, drafts moving about the window sashes and frames. Cold from the window glass washed my face, rested a chill hand on my chest. Betty snored lightly. I tipped the chair against the radiator and, with a teenager's false nostalgia, dreamed warm dreams of someday buying this house for Betty. Of our children in the sunlit backyard, struggling to do pull-ups on the clothesline poles, are running to show us four-leaf clovers they found.
John Reimringer set out to write a book about a man who happens to be a priest. He is not untouchable or someone unable to relate to. He's human. We would like to thank John for sitting down with us for an interview and for his reading as part of the Great River Reading Series. Tune in next Tuesday afternoon at 12:30 for part two of our interview and reading right here on ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.